Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for April 20th, 2010. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. Today I'm speaking with Ravi Iyengar and Seth Berger about a study published in today's issue of Science Signaling in which they describe integrating protein-protein interaction data with genetics data to enable the prediction of adverse drug effects. Specifically, they looked at genes associated with long QT, a type of cardiac arrhythmia. Seth and Ravi spoke to me from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Seth, what is long QT syndrome and what sort of gene products have been implicated in this disease?
Well, long QT syndrome is an inherited or acquired prolongation of the QT interval as observed on an EKG, an electrocardiogram. A change in QT interval is clinically used as an indicator for the risk of certain dangerous arrhythmias. For the congenital forms of the disorder, 13 genes have been identified which contain causative mutations in affected individuals. These genes encode ion channels in the heart, which give rise to the myocyte action potential, and several other interacting proteins which regulate their function. Interestingly, there are also many FDA-approved medications which can cause acquired long QT syndrome in otherwise normal patients. Most of these drugs block the Hergs potassium channel, one of the known long QT syndrome disease genes. However, the degree of blockade does not directly correlate with the risk of the adverse event.
Can someone have this type of arrhythmia for a long period of time, or is it generally a fast-progressing, lethal sort of disease?
It really varies from patient to patient. Some people have a more serious form, and it presents rather early in childhood. Other people may never find out they have the disease until later in life. In fact, many cases of drug-induced long QT syndrome are previously undiagnosed cases of the congenital form that is only brought out by taking the drug.
So someone is put on a drug to treat some condition, and then it has the side effect of causing this long QT.
Exactly.
One of the most recent examples, I think,
are
these new drugs for cancer treatment targeted to the kinases, you know? People take it and it's good cancer therapy, but they develop cardiac arrhythmias.
You looked at the set of genes that have been implicated in long QT syndrome from genetic studies, and you looked at these in the context of the human interactome, which is the entire collection of molecular interactions that occur in humans. And what did you find about the distribution of the long QT genes in the human interactome?
Well, first of all, not all the interactions in the interactome are currently known. However, we have a significant number of interactions that we were able to pull from the literature of around 77,000 interactions that we collected from various databases. Now, we identified a neighborhood of gene products in the human interactome which selectively interact with the gene products involved in congenital long QT syndromes. We demonstrated that this neighborhood was distinct from other disease gene neighborhoods, and that when you look at the overlap between these different disease neighborhoods, you can kind of see a relationship between the overlap of the disease gene neighborhood and the symptoms of the diseases. Furthermore, we found that we could use our long QT neighborhood to classify the targets of QT prolonging drugs and validated this by looking at a database of adverse event reports.
In this study, you specifically looked at genes that are involved in long QT syndrome, but there are other types of cardiac arrhythmias. Do the genes that affect these other types of arrhythmias also cluster with the long QT genes? And do the same sorts of drugs cause long QT and other types of arrhythmia?
Essentially, when we were looking at the various disease gene neighborhoods, we found that there was definitely a large degree of overlap between the long QT neighborhood and other cardiac disease neighborhoods. And thus, drug targets that fell in one often fell in another. This degree of overlap is not completely surprising because we are dealing with regulation of ion channels, and most of these diseases in the heart are dealing with the dysregulation of ion channels.
So once you had these disease gene neighborhoods from the interactome, then you combined this information with genetic information on SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, that are associated with long QT.
Basically, by using the neighborhood to look at only the SNPs that fall around genes that ranked highly in our neighborhood, we are looking at a smaller number of SNPs than at a genome-wide association study. By looking at a smaller number of SNPs, you can set the cutoff for significance as being smaller, and thus you can capture things that did not make genome-wide significance but were significant among the SNPs that you actually look at in this case.
Yeah, this is Ravi. So he compared this interactome data with the SNPs. Since the SNP analysis is done on a whole genome-wide basis, the ones that are the strongest correlation with the disease show up from the statistical analysis. However, there are some that are below sort of the statistical cutoff, and Seth's usage of the interactome as a framing device to sort of highlight areas on the chromosomes that may be important for genes that encode functions related to QT regulation allowed him to now catch a couple of other SNPs that are likely to play a role in patients, in select patients. You know, you can call this like a physiologic or a biologic filter or a functional filter.
So how did you use this data to make predictions about adverse side effects that might be induced by drugs?
Essentially,
Seth?
We used multiple different sources of data that we were able to integrate to combine these data sets. There is a clinically used list of drugs which are known to either prolong the QT interval or have side effects associated with prolonged QT intervals, or are recommended to be avoided in patients who have congenital long QT syndrome because these drugs are known to make it worse. So we used that list of drugs, and we combined that with another database called Drug Bank, which has a list of drugs and their associated targets. So now that we have a relationship between drugs and their targets, we were able to overlay that onto our network and identify which nodes in our network are drug targets. By looking at the relative rankings of the targets of drugs that are known to prolong the QT interval compared to the targets of drugs that are not known to prolong the QT interval, we saw that the targets of drugs that are known to prolong the QT interval tended to rank higher than the targets of drugs that did not have the side effect.
Were you able to use this information to identify some drugs which might have the adverse effect of lengthening the QT interval but have not yet been described to do so?
In order to do that, we went to another source of data. We went to the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System data set, and we looked at drugs that were not previously described to prolong the QT interval, so they are not in the known list of drugs that have the side effect, yet were associated with an event report in the Adverse Event Reporting System database where they were the only drug that was reported, and they also hit a high-ranking target in our long QT neighborhood. By combining these, we were now able to find drugs that we had a higher suspicion of having the side effect because they hit a high-ranking target in our neighborhood. Plus, there is some case report out there of them having the side effect. So we feel that this can help us more quickly identify events like this in the database because you have an increased level of suspicion that the drug will have the side effect due to its target in our neighborhood.
Ravi?
So in the neighborhood that Seth generated, in addition to the known disease genes, there are lots of protein interacting proteins, and many of these turn out to be targets for these drugs that cause QT prolongation as an adverse event. So since he's able to statistically rank the various nodes in an orderly way, he can now predict which drug, because of which target it binds to, may have a higher or lower chance of producing a QT interval-related adverse event. So it becomes sort of a predictive tool for new drugs as well, and he's done this ranking these various kinase inhibitors, some of which have data in the clinical literature and others that don't. Almost all of these target signaling proteins of one sort or another, and you can predict some which might have a higher chance of producing an QT-related adverse event and others not. So it becomes a predictive tool. The other aspect of this is, you know, doctors across the U.S., when they, in hospitals, when they find an adverse event, they are required to report this to the FDA AERS database, adverse events reporting system. And so there are all these incidents that are reported where people don't understand why it happened. By using SETS ranked list, we are now able to provide an initial insight into why a certain drug may have caused this adverse event, because there is a target in the neighborhood that may be close to a well-known QT event disease gene. So it both illuminates events that have occurred and it makes predictions. And both of these can now be further tested in animal models and other things, you know.
So are you able to tell that, for example, people that have a certain SNP profile are more susceptible to an adverse side effect from a drug than people that have a different SNP profile? Seth?
At this point, our underlying data sets lack directionality and lack strength of interactions. It's all undirected, unsigned interactions. Therefore, it makes it difficult for us to claim whether a particular gene or a particular change in a gene is going to be increasing the risk of an arrhythmia or decreasing the risk of arrhythmia. What it comes down to essentially is a guilt by association. You fall near these genes that are known to have this effect. Therefore, we think that you are likely to have this effect as well. So we cannot get to that level of detail with the data set that we have at this point.
Ravi?
And that will require a different type of modeling, which is dynamical modeling, similar to what is done for current drug studies, but not at this level of molecular details, what is called PK/PD or pharmacokinetic pharmacodynamic modeling. In the future, that will have to be integrated with these types of network analyses to sort of yield the information the type that you're asking. But I think that's a little bit away, maybe 5 or 10 years. So in a futuristic scenario where one shows up at the doctor's office with a little, say, I don't know, thumb drive with your human genome sequence annotated with the SNPs or whatever, one might envisage that the doctor has some programs that will allow her to sort of look at what sort of SNPs there are, what sort of treatments, and how might this sort of genomic information relate to proteins that might be in neighborhoods that cause arrhythmias. And then, so if you were getting a drug for a proliferative disorder or cancer treatment, depending on what your SNP profile is, you may or may not want to use one type of an inhibitor versus another, you know?
Thanks to both of you for speaking with me.
Thank you for talking to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Ravi Iyengar and Seth Berger, authors of a research article published in the April 20th issue of Science Signaling. That article is by Berger and colleagues, and it's titled Systems Pharmacology of Arrhythmias. That wraps up this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. This show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.